Let's get our rhythm and find a happy ending. How timeless can one song be? All right, let's come back to reality. Once again, good morning to you, and thank you very much for tuning in. This is SFM's Overnight. Let's talk about Fidel Castro. Yes, you heard me right, Fidel Castro. When I was talking about Fidel Castro with a friend of mine on the phone this morning, it was a very a bittersweet conversation because you could pick up an air of disappointment that we don't feel the full strength of Fidel, almost as though he's dead. Yeah. Anyway, that's what was happening. But let's get to know the history about Fidel Castro. So remember, this is Thursday morning, which means we have a history tunnel. We go back in time and talk about historical figures in our time and times yesteryear. And this time around, we're focusing on Fidel Castro. And to give us some perspective and some insights on this great revolutionary, we have our own historian. He's an advocate of law, is Push Cummy. He always comes through for us to help us navigate our way through history. And Push Cummy, by the way, he's not just an advocate, he's an editor. He's the editor of the New African Magazine and the founder of Real African Writers Page. And I'm sure if you're one of those people who have stumbled upon his pages on Facebook, or actually, you're one of the writers, you'll appreciate his work. Push, good morning to you once again. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us.
Yeah, good morning, my. Well, great to see you again.
After a long, long while, yeah.
Yes.
Tell me, do you also have these fond, warm, fuzzy feelings about Fidel Castro, or was it just my friend alone who feels a sense of nostalgia of his absence in the public sphere?
So absolutely. So the Castro was a huge inspirational revolutionary figure. You know, that stood like a colossus on the world stage for the past 50 years or so.
Yeah.
And personally, yes, because I invited us to Cuba, well, not directly, in 1984. I spent 7 months in Cuba and learned a lot of Spanish, and at first hand, you know, witnessed, you know, what was happening in Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. So yes, I spent 7 months in Cuba. So, and Cuba has a very special, you know, place in my heart.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, are you one of those people who believes he died a long time ago? It's only being announced recently.
No, that's just part of the myth. You know, he's almost become a mythical figure, right? And soon, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of movies and, you know, comics about him. They say he died a long time ago. He didn't die a long time ago, despite 638 assassination attempts
Yes.
on his life. You know, by all the presidents, practically perhaps except Obama, you know, by all the presidents of the U.S.,
Yeah.
he managed to survive all of them.
Yes.
And that's why he's almost become like a kind of Christ-like figure, and we probably will have to wait for his second coming.
A second coming. Right.
Yeah,
Well, I suppose because some people do feel like it's some sort of a messiah, especially for Cuba, or at least for the revolutionaries of the time. They do feel like he was one of those greatest figures, to the point that when his brother took over from him, it was as though it was a coup d'etat, because nobody wanted Castro to leave power. And it was as though somebody poisoned him, and many myths came out, and nobody actually knew exactly what was going on. But when Raul took over, it was not, he didn't garner so much favor as his brother Fidel. Or is this also another myth?
look, it's inevitable that he would have to step down, you know, because of ill health. And by the time he was well advanced in age, in 2006, when he started handing over power to his brother. But we should also note that Raul, his younger brother, was with him all the time, throughout all their, you know, revolutionary movements and wars, you know, and battles that they fought to overthrow government,
yeah,
and, you know, revolutionary activities in the whole of Latin America.
Yeah.
Raul was by sight all the time. So it was inevitable that whoever went first, the other would take over.
Yeah.
Yes. So that is it. It was to be expected.
All right.
With the kind of political system that they had in place, even there.
Let's rewind.
Everything was well organized, yes.
Let's rewind way, way back, way back. We're talking now in the year 2016, but this is a man who died at the age of 90. So we have 90 years of his life to traverse in this conversation. Let's go back and talk about Raul. His name, his full name, we're told, is Fidel Alejandro Castro Ruz. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Ruth was actually his mother's name. And his mother was a maid to Fidel Castro's first wife. And then we understood that when the marriage fell apart, then he married the maid. Fidel Castro was actually born out of wedlock, but then was fully recognized by his father, who was a rich, you know, quite wealthy farmer, you know, very well off. And when he married the maid, then Castro changed his name at the age of 17 from the Ruz to Castro, you know, became formally known as Fidel Castro. So that was, you know, that's where the roots come from. And then the other Castro's name at the age of 17.
Mm. We are told that he is born of this father of his who was a sugarcane farmer. But I'm curious, what does a sugarcane farmer have to do with politics? How did it happen that Castro would, at that very elementary age, adopt some anti-imperialist politics? Was his father a politician?
No, not at all. As I've mentioned earlier, the father was a farmer.
Yeah.
He owned plantations and sold fruits to one of the big American companies, you know, United Fruits. And as a result, you know, he became very wealthy. So his father had nothing directly to do with politics.
Yeah.
And even Fidel Castro himself, you know, was a politically immature. I mean, he did not have an interest in politics until 1947.
When he went to Havana University.
Yes, when he enrolled at the University of Havana to study law.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
his background was not poor. I mean, you would say he was middle class, upper middle class. But I suppose his own influence has led him to now, you know, become a champion of the poor and the oppressed. But his political awakening came when he actually went to university. And you can imagine that was at the age of 21.
Mm.
You know, he was born in the 13th of August, 1926. So in 1947, that's when his political awakening began at the age of 21 years.
Mm.
And for a 21-year-old, what he managed to achieve and what he did, you know, it's the stuff of legends.
Yes. You know, I was watching a documentary, and I'm one of the suckers for documentaries. I was watching a documentary about Fidel and how he got accidentally involved in politics. It was because we're told, and I want you to verify this if you can, that he was taking a road trip, an uncanny road trip, and then he bumped into situations that triggered a sense of injustice that needs to be righted. And so he decided when he came back that he'll join and find out if there is anything that can be done. Can you verify that it was an accidental meeting with injustice that sparked his political ire?
Yeah, that has become part of the narrative. But with respect to the systems that existed in his time, those were what we call strictly capitalist systems in which around him, yeah, they did see, you know, the conditions of the poor and marginalized and how they were oppressed. And how Cuba had literally been taken over by, you know, the American capitalists.
Mm.
It's part of the legend, or it's part of the narrative, a personal narrative of those who were close up to him. So, you know, we cannot dispute it. But what is indisputable is the fact that he saw all around him the condition of the very poor people who were the, all those sugarcane fields and the food farms, you know, and the benefits went to the rich American capitalists who used, you know, Cuba as the only day resort. You know, so that awoken him. Even though he himself, as I mentioned earlier, did not suffer poverty. It is a mark of a great man that, you know, he was not insensitive to what he saw around him.
Yeah. Tell me, Push, well, then what is it about Batista that he did not like? What happened that caused him to want to overthrow Batista?
You know, Batista became a military dictator. Batista simply came to power in 1952. He became a dictator. You know, Batista was not fully, they had a political process in place, you know, by which they had elections. And at that time, for the Castro, at the age of 22, he had traveled around to Bogota, to Colombia, to various places, you know, to participate in anti-government routes, and, you know, to agitate against this capitalist government. Even when the Dominican Republic, he tried to overthrow, you know, dictated at the age of 21. At the age of 22, he was in Bogota, Colombia, and various places. And when he came back, he joined a party called the Partido Ortodoxo, and supported the president called Eduardo Chibos.
Hold on, Push. You're leaving me behind. You say Batista took over power in 52, but that's not historically correct, because we're told that Batista took over much, much earlier. In fact, he was elected president of Cuba from 1940 to 1944, and then dictator from 1952 to 59.
Yeah, that's correct. Why I jumped to 1952 is because that was when Fidel Castro, it was from that period that Fidel Castro embarked on his campaign to overthrow him.
Yes.
But as you already mentioned, he was elected before and then he went out of power.
Yes.
But then when he came back in 1952, he came back through the barrel of the gun. He came and he overthrew. He was a military man. He was General Fulgencio Batista. You know, he was a military man. So when he came back, he overthrew the government violently, and then he became a dictator, and then aligned himself with the U.S. Government and all those capitalists. And then that's when, after Castro's, well, leader or godfather Chibos shot himself at the radio station in 1951.
Yeah,
he then, you know, embarked upon a campaign to overthrow Batista, you know, because at that time, all these conditions that we've talked about earlier, you know, worsened. You know, the plight of the poor worsened, and Batista was just a very corrupt dictator as well. So that's when then he went on a campaign to get rid of him.
But you see, even I'm observing a pattern here. I'm hoping you can see it also. Yes. Castro is not known to be the best of heads of state in all of the world. Hence, there were sanctions by the U.S. against him. And I suppose, even right now, there are some people who don't have much love for Fidel Castro. But when he took over, he was overthrowing a dictator. And that dictator was Batista. Even with Batista, he came to power in 1933, the first time he saw the realm of power, even though he was at the head of it, he was then doing what Castro was doing also, overthrowing another dictator, Geraldo Machado, correct? Now, this is what I'm trying to understand is it ever possible that you could hate something so much that you become it. Because Fidel Castro hated dictatorship so much that so many people say he turned and he became a dictator. Same applies with Fulgencio Batista. He hated dictatorship so much that he became a dictator. The same applies with Gerardo Machado, that he hated. All these guys seem to come to power overthrowing a dictator and then ending up becoming it. Would this be a fair observation?
Yes, because of his ideological leanings and also the belligerence of the U.S., you know, when he came into power, that forced him to lean ideologically to communism and socialism and also to the Soviet Union. And the political systems that were in place, you know, in places like the Soviet Union, you know, was effectively a dictatorship of what we say, the dictatorship of the proletariat.
The proletariat, yes.
But you realize that when he came to power, he himself was not the first prime minister. The prime minister was somebody else until, you know, but he resigned, you know, he resigned. And then subsequently, Fidel Castro became the prime minister. But yes, effectively, you could say that he was a dictator. But he was a dictator on behalf of the oppressed and marginalized.
Okay.
Exactly. All the changes that he made, all the reforms that he came about. Yes. On the balance sheet, yes. As he himself wrote in his book, History Absorbed Me. And look, they made a lot of achievements, and there were also accusations of brutality and all that. But that's, you know, why we are talking about him today.
Yeah.
And the fact that he ended up as a legend and a great man.
Yes.
That's why we are talking about him today.
So he makes this attempt first at Batista, launching this attack, which failed in 1953. Can you outline what exactly happened? Because you would have assumed that, knowing very well that Batista himself is one of the great military leaders, why would he make such a flimsy attempt at overthrowing him to the point that he got himself thrown into jail?
Yes, but that's really the mark of the man. I mean, you're fearless. You're fearless and very, you know, determined. And look at that time, you know, how old, you know, he would have been. In 1953, if we calculate, you know, he would have been nearly 27 years old. And you can imagine that, a 27-year-old today, what is he up to? You know, he's busy hanging around.
Indeed.
Nightclubs.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, you're right. Having a tough time finishing his degree or diploma or something. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but look at him, 21 years running around countries, traveling from country to country, trying to overthrow government.
Yeah, wanting to rule.
Yes, and in 1953, he actually goes and then takes on a military general, you know, a general, you know, somebody, an older man with a background, who's been president before, as you mentioned,
yeah.
But one nation before.
Yeah.
So that was it. You know, that was very pivotal. When I was in Cuba, July 26, 1953 was one of the days that were, you know, was the celebrated days, one of, you know, in Cuban history. Because that was the time that he actually propelled his career of, you know, his revolutionary career with action, you know, on the Cuban front.
Yes.
He formed the movement after this Partido Ortodoxo, which, you know, he backed.
Yeah.
He didn't have a lot of ideological or Marxist leanings. He failed, and the president killed himself. Then he formed the movement, you know, a movement, and with 150 supporters, they attacked the military barracks in Santiago de Cuba. Santiago de Cuba, you know, Cuba is like, you know, it's a long island, almost looking like an alligator.
Mm.
So, you know, it's long and it's, you know, it's not, doesn't have much weight. But he started off in Santiago the Cuba. It's from Havana. It's right at the other end of the tail of these alligators that I'm talking about. He started off there and attacked a major military barrack. And, you know, the objective was to seize arms and then fight their way to Havana to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's extremely courageous. I mean, they had the courage to do that. But unfortunately, that failed.
Oh, you're referring to the Moncada barracks?
Yeah, at Moncada. Yeah. At the Moncada military barracks in Santiago de Cuba. And when it failed, then he seeped into the national consciousness, you know, because then he became very well known. But even before then, he had written articles in which he had appeared on the front pages of newspapers. But then that's when now he drew attention. He captured the imagination of most of the Cuban people. Unfortunately, he was arrested, and he and Raul was always by his side. Yeah, Raul, who had been traveling around the whole of Latin America for mental revolution, you know, there again, they were captured and they were sentenced to 15 years. But luckily, for some reason unknown, they were granted amnesty in 1965, and I'm sure the authorities at that time had done their homework well. You know, that amnesty, maybe they shouldn't have given it to him.
Yes, yes, in hindsight, yes. So when we see him trying and failing with the Manjada barracks, we notice that he gets himself in trouble with his brother Raul, and then enters this very famous name of Che Guevara. How did these guys know each other?
They met in Mexico. You know, after they got their amnesty in 1955, he and Raul traveled to Mexico and then continued to plan a revolution. You know, these were dyed-in-the-wool revolutionaries, you know, who wanted to change the world. So they got there, and that's where they met with Che Guevara,
yes,
who at the time was a doctor, Argentine doctor. And, you know, through the interaction, Che Guevara also had an influence, you know, a significant influence on the Marxist influence on the thinking of both of them.
Yeah.
And with him, and, you know, with him by his side and encouraged by him also, then that's when then they set off on December the 2nd, 1956, from Mexico, aboard a very famous, you know, a boat called the Grama.
Mm-hmm.
And in Cuba, ever since I was there in 1984, it was almost 5 years ago. But the Grama is the national newspaper, the national newspaper of Cuba. But and that was exactly the boat that they set sail on, with 80 insurgents and weapons, and then once again landed on the East Coast to start the revolution, you know, that eventually overthrew the government.
Mm.
And that was in 1956.
You want
me to take you through the what happened at the, you know, with this London.
Hold on, before you go there, Push. I'm curious that we don't see much of his education. Almost all the time when people talk about Fidel Castro, they begin with his military exploits, and hardly ever do we see him going to school. Do we have any information about him going to school, earning a high school certificate, earning a diploma of sorts or a degree? Do we know? Do we have any information about his academic acquisitions?
Yes, he was very, very well educated. He went to Jesuit schools, you know, these Christian schools. You know, Cuba at that time was very Catholic. And like I said, his father was well off. Those Jesuit schools were high-class schools. He went to the Jesuit schools in Santiago de Cuba, and also another college called Colegio Dolores. And then from there, went to another college called Colegio de Belen in Havana. And then until then, he passed or graduated, and then went to the law school in Havana.
The University of Havana.
1947.
But you
see, and then subsequently, actually, in 1950, he earned his doctorate in law. And at some point, actually tried to practice law, but he was practicing law defending the poor, and you see, that's also quite significant. These days, when lawyers have a reputation of you know being rapacious for money.
Yes, yes. And then present company included.
I'm not speaking for myself.
Yeah.
His practice collapsed, you know, because he was not taking money. And he got rather practice without money.
Okay.
So, like I'm saying, he was very well educated and for the doctorate in law, actually practiced a while. Then, now decided to go into full time politics and subsequently become a full time revolutionary.
Yeah.
So, he was very, very well educated.
All right. So are you saying with all these colleges that you're saying he acquired some form of certification?
Yes. He got certificates from those schools. He passed. What you know about him was that they say he was average at that time when he went to those schools. You know, they were well high-class schools, well-being schools. You know, all the missionary schools were middle class to upper class. He was academically, they said he was average, but he was more into sports. You know, he used to play baseball and basketball. But he was intelligent and you know average, except that he perhaps wasn't interested too much in academics. But like I mentioned, you know, if he went all the way to pass his law degree and get a doctorate in law, he was a very intelligent man.
Okay. All right.
After all those boarding schools that he went to, you know, he went to three of them.
Okay. All right. So, when we see him trying this failed attempt at against Batista, we're told that he went to, or he at least launched some other revolutions. He led some other revolutions in other countries or in other states. What was going on there?
As I mentioned, you know, what the Dominican Republic, you know, he wanted to go through the country's dictator. His name was Rafael Trujillo. You know, he joined the coup attempt, which failed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, in 1948, at the age of 22, he traveled to Bogota,
yes,
Colombia, to participate in an anti-government rout. You know, and then he traveled to the Dominican Republic to team up with anti-government insurgents. You know, most of them, yes, did not end up in any success. But that didn't stop him, you know, from there. And then he went to Mexico.
Yes.
You know, to go and foment trouble and plan a revolution, you know, in Mexico.
Yes.
That didn't happen.
To foment trouble.
Like I can see the back of the man. I
mean, yes, yes.
Like I said, the man whose blood was revolution, you know, to change what he saw around him.
Yes.
Until then, it was in Mexico, as we already mentioned, that he met Che Guevara.
Yes.
And then they planned to now come back to Cuba to get rid of Batista. So that was in his blood. Revolution was in his blood. And subsequently, you've seen that, and when I was in Cuba, that was it. I mean, they were very emphatic on being internationalists. And from there, he wanted to change the world. And
yes.
He aligned with Latin American countries and oppressed countries around the world.
Yes.
And I'm sure at some point we'll also discuss Cuito Cuanavale.
Yes, yes, in the context of our own country, yes. But before we even go there, we then see him retaliating because after the Americans wanted to take him out, trying to kill him, trying to assassinate him, trying to cause some revolutions against him, he then forms a very odd association with the Soviet Union. What was going on there? Because at the time, the status quo in the world over was volatile, which sparked the Cuban Missile Crisis. What was going on there? Was he planning on starting or inciting World War, Cold War, or was he really baying for blood, looking for a world war?
Well, Castro simply, I'll call him a god of social justice. He simply did not like the inequalities that he saw around him. And he wanted to change things. And obviously that came into conflict with, ideologically, with the U.S., you know, which had a very strong influence on Cuba. Yes, just remember that Cuba is just only 90 miles away from the U.S.
Yes.
So
with water in between?
Cuba. Yeah, it's 90 miles away to Florida, Key West, Florida.
Yes.
Just 90 miles. Sea, but, you know, there's a sea. And 90 miles, an island.
Indeed.
You know. So there's 90 miles of water between them. So America had always seen Cuba as their backyard, you know, as a playground or their backyard.
Mm.
But at that time, there were all these large American companies that controlled everything, you know, from the plantations, sugarcane plantations, tobacco, all the infrastructure and everything else, the casinos and hotels. You know, not too different from what Puerto Rico is today.
Okay.
You know. So then, Castro was unhappy, and then when he overtook Batista in 1958, he started embarking on reforms, you know. He started embarking on reforms by land reform, in which he reduced the size of the land that each individual can hold to about 939 acres. Look, what happened there is not much different from, you know, after independence that where African countries, you know, experience. It's not different from South Africa. But he now embarked upon, you know, a concerted effort to change everything. And then he has corporated, you know, he has put, you know, he has promoted the land, redistributed the land, he nationalized some of those industries that he saw as exploitative. And all these actions, you know, of course, Americans don't like it. So then there was a reaction from America. All these nationalizing, they were unhappy about it. So then, that's when then the Americans also started to, you know, plot against him. And, you know, at some point, then they refused to supply him with oil, so then he was forced to go to the Soviet Union. So some of, you know, his actions were forced by the belligerence or the hostility of that very powerful neighbor.
Hmm.
And then what happened, then he went to Soviet Union, then started buying oil from the Soviet Union, and then the American company who controlled the oil refineries at some point refused to refine this oil. And the country cannot run without energy. So he took over the oil refineries. You know, he also industrialized the refineries. And then what would you expect? Then now the U.S. would say, you small little boy, you know, come in your nose at us. So then the U.S. also reacted, and then now the group diplomatic relations. Eisenhower at that time, you know, was the president until Kennedy came to power in 1961.
Mm.
But Eisenhower, you know, as part of his policy, you know, also involved assassinations. I mean, he's touted as the one who ordered the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And by some accounts, they said he made 38 attempts on the life of Fidel Castro.
Yes.
Then, after a lot of all these actions, then Castro also reacted, action and reaction. He also reacted and then, you know, declared Cuba a socialist state. And then, as well, you know, before he left the power, you know, he finished his term of office in 1961, then broke diplomatic relations with Cuba, and then they embarked upon all these trade embargoes. And then that has persisted, you know, until today, until Obama tried to make his reforms.
Yes.
So that's what happened. Action and reaction. You know, they didn't like what Castro was doing. They wanted to punish him, hit him with a big stick. And he also reacted and formed new alliances, survival together with his ideological leanings. And then that hostility persisted until, failed assassination attempts and until what we call the Bay of Pigs in 1961 and then the nuclear, you know, missile crisis.
But what happened to the Bay of Pigs was not just an attempt on his life. It was an invasion. It's a full-on invasion by the Americans, wasn't it? Failed yes, as it well, was, but it was a full-on invasion.
Yes, and then before that, you know, according to certain accounts, Eisenhower, I tried 38 times to kill Castro.
and failed 39 times.
And then Kennedy came into power, the famous Kennedy.
Yes.
Then Kennedy came into power. And when he came to power, then they tried to invade Cuba and overthrow his government in what we call the Bay of Pigs. Also, the Bay of Pigs is you know, widely celebrated in Cuba. When I was there in April 1961, what happened here was they organized all these rebels, the anti-Castro crowd, most of whom were in Florida. Those who didn't like Castro, when Castro came to power, especially with respect to seizing properties, fled. A lot of them. But some say, look, it could be up to 120,000. Fled to Florida. And from Florida, then they were organized by the U.S. government, the CIA, and armed and trained to go back to Cuba and overthrow the Castro's government. And they landed at the Bay of Pigs. But they got a hint of them. And then they rallied the population. Castro rallied the population and his military. And they crashed, they arrested them and, shot them and arrested. I think there was a force of about 1,400 men. And that's what became the Bay of Pigs. In Cuba, there's a famous, very famous story about one of the young boys who rallied to go and defend the country at Bay of Pigs, and when he was dying, wrote the name of Fidel Castro, with his blood. that's just some of the trivia about the Bay of Pigs invasion, 1961.
Yeah. So we see a man who, well, according to his own thoughts, he was better than the dictator before him, as was the case with the one before him. And now they try to take him out. When the CIA tries to send their brigade to take him out, what was happening with the Cuban people? Were they okay with the rulership, albeit termed the dictatorship of Fidel, or what was going on as far as the Cuban people? Because not after that do we see that there is another hostile takeover, or another revolution, or another invasion, or another coup d'etat. What happened? What was happening with the Cuban people at the time?
What was happening in Cuba, the Cuban people, it's not dissimilar to, the period, that particular period in the history of things. It was a very dull same period that in various parts of Latin America, especially, you had several coup d'etats, right? It was within that same period. Subsequently, somewhere down the line, it also happened in Africa, where we had several coup d'etats. So it was not uncommon that there were violent overthrows of governments, in the whole of Latin America. Even further down the line, yes, there were violent overthrows, even in Spain, there was a violent overthrow of government, but that was way back in 1974. In Portugal, there was a kind of revolution also run about in 1974. So it wasn't unusual. Democracy as we know it today, I'm not taking much roots, roots. And in Latin America, revolutions, were the order of the day. And that's why we saw Castro just moving around countries trying to foment revolutions. And most of the leaders of that time, in Latin America, have come to power by military coup d'etat. And we have rebel groups, in places Nicaragua, Salvador, El Salvador, all those other countries. So that was it. That was it. That was the ambiance of the political ambiance at that time. Elections followed by coup d'etats, and then that was it.
And you're suggesting that the people were happy with Fidel Castro?
Yes, when he took power in 1958, I mean, he was a very popular figure. Because from 1956, at that time, when he sailed from Mexico and then they landed there, they actually ambushed and then a lot of the people slaughtered. But, a lot of the men whom he arrived with, his insurgents were slaughtered. And he and Raul, it's almost like they were men of destiny. He and his little brother were not captured. I mean, they managed to go into the forest and then organize the peasants and actually effectively run a government, a parallel government in the southeast of Cuba. And also from 1956 to 1958, the whole country knew about Fidel Castro. He was literally running provinces there. So by 1958, when he actually marched into Havana to overthrow Batista, who fled, and some say he fled with $300 million in Dominican Republic. When he got there, he was a very, very popular figure. Along the way, he had gone to villages and greeted. He was marching triumphantly into Cuba, meeting and making speeches with all the peasants and villages by the roadside before he marched into there. So he was very popular and very well, welcome. And look, he's been a popular figure for a long period of time. And he's had the support of the people, Cuban people, behind him, since then. Especially, due to the reforms that he brought about and how he tried to erase the inequalities that existed in Cuba at that time. By the time I arrived there in 1984, yes, he was still a very popular figure in Cuba. Economic hardships, would make the Cubans, some of them, speak negatively about him. But generally, they appreciated his achievements of health, education, and all those things, the access to land and everything that he brought to Cuba.
All right. We're in conversation with Push Kami right here on Overnight with me, Nayelu Pondona, trying to navigate our way through this thick fog of the life and times of Fidel Castro, the now late Fidel Castro. He died 25th of November 2016, died at the age of 90, and some people are still crying for him. Some people believe, well, we're just being told now he died a long time ago. Ever since Raul took over, he has not been prominent in the public space and so forth and so forth and so forth. And so now we're trying to trace our way into his life. I'm fully aware that we will not finish all of the things that he did and all of his exploits, but we will try and give you as much as we can in conversation with Push Kami. Now let's go back there, Push. We see Fidel Castro being a darling to hate by the CIA. Why? Is it because of the riches that he was depriving the Americans, or was there a legitimate cause? Because during Kennedy's bid for election in the 60s, even in the 1960, he was talking about the missile gap, which gives me the impression that perhaps it was not just about their wealth in Cuba, but there was a legitimate threat of these missiles, which led to the missile threat or the scare or the crisis, whatever you want to call it.
Most of the hostility towards Cuba was ideological. Ideological one, because now Cuba had aligned itself with a sworn enemy of the United States, the Soviet Union. At that time, after the First World War, the Soviet Union had embarked upon a different ideology of Marxism and Leninism, and had carved out the Soviet Empire, I mean, Eastern Europe and East Germany and Poland and all those other countries, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, all of them were part of the Soviet bloc. And then they saw Soviet as a threat. They saw the Soviet Union as a threat to the Western capitalist countries. And ideologically, the whole idea of socialism was that, eventually it's going to lead to the overthrow of capitalism. So those were the ideological divides. And now you've got somebody who now has declared himself an avowed Marxist, you know, Marxist-Leninist, and who sees an island that is 90 miles away from, you know, your country. So then he was a fool that, you know, they had to just get rid of. And in furtherance of that idea was the fact that he had nationalism, he had embarked upon that cause of socialism by seizing American wealth and property, nationalizing them. So then he became an arch enemy of the United States of America. And that's what reached ahead with what you mentioned, the nuclear missile crisis. You know, because, and that happened, you know, because after now, all these attempts to overthrow him and assassinate him, after the Bay of Pigs, now, Castro needed a big brother to defend him. So that's when then he spoke to Nikita Khrushchev, and they decided to come and install nuclear missiles 90 miles away from the U.S., you know, in Cuba. But that was also partly because at that time, the U.S. had also installed nuclear missiles in Turkey, you know, which, you know, borders, you know, the USSR, the Soviet Union at that time.
Yes.
So those were some of the dynamics. But to have an ally who's so close to you, that was, you know, unacceptable. You know, absolutely unacceptable by the U.S. And then that's when now the hostility towards the Castro intensified.
Yeah, yeah. And why did the Chinese feel the need to participate in all of it? Because they were nowhere clear or nothing close to Florida. So what was their scare?
Which people?
The Chinese. The Chinese people were told that 650,000, in fact, it's 650 million Chinese men and women were standing by the Cuban people supporting this whole situation. What was going on there? We were told
I remember that the Chinese was communist. It was communist China.
Yes.
It was only in recent times that they embarked upon reforms, capitalist reforms, but Chinese has always been a communist state. You know, so, you know, it was supporting a communist ally and the expansion of communism.
Hence the Cold War, because we're told even the Germans supported the Americans and so forth and so forth and so forth.
Yeah, so the communist ideology in itself was an existential threat to America, to the U.S. So then that was it. That's how the world was divided, communism and capitalism. And the forces that went with it, and with military power and nuclear weapons in the mix. So the Chinese obviously would you know, side with, you know, ideologically with you know, the Fidel Castro.
Okay, all right. And then when we speak of the Cold War, can we say that it was incited by the Americans, or it was incited or started by Castro? Who started this whole situation, Kennedy or Castro?
Now the Cold War itself, you know, was birthed after the Second World War when the various factions, you know, most of it was born by Lenin and Marx, you know, and the writings of Karl Marx and Lenin, but after the Second World War, the Soviet Union embarked upon a particular ideological leanings, and then with the defeat of Germany, they carved out their empire, and America was, you know, also carved out. They divided, for instance, they divided Germany. They started dividing up portions of Europe. You know, so that's where now you've got North Korea and South Korea. North Korea has still remained communist. And then you had East Germany, we had West Germany. So then, you know, the world was divided into two, with capitalism, you know, backed by the godfather U.S. and communism backed by the godfather Soviet Union. And that's what became the Cold War. And then, you know, in Cuba, Fidel Castro came into the mix. He overthrew a capitalist, Batista, and then turned the island state into a communist, you know, country. So then it means now you have moved into the column of the communists. And then that's how it came about. You know, the ideological divide, you know, became, and then that's how it's been going on ever since.
So
yeah. The collapse of the Soviet Union, yeah.
So in your view, who started it? Castro or Kennedy?
No, the Cold War was between the Soviet Union and the U.S. You know, but if you talk about the Cold War between the U.S. and or the blockade of Cuba, the belligerence, you know, the enmity of what is described as the Cold War is, you know, was between the Soviet Union and America, but with respect to the, you know, between Cuba and America, you know, that started in 1958 when he came to power and then started embarking upon these socialist reforms. And that was within the reign or at the time when Dwight Eisenhower of the U.S. was in power. So it was already in place. And it was actually Eisenhower who broke diplomatic relations, you know, with Cuba. And as I mentioned, when Eisenhower was in power, by some statistics, you know, by Cuban intelligence officers, he made 38 attempts. So it wasn't Kennedy. Kennedy simply just inherited, you know, U.S. policy at that time when he came to power in 1960.
Okay. All right. And then we are told that he had a wife. Tell us about his wife, his personal life, because that too is something that is rather elusive. We're told about his 47-year-old marriage, which then we are not told much about his matrimonial or love interests. Share with us his love interests.
Yeah, he was actually married. He first got married to a lady by the name of Meta Diaz Balat in 1948. Until 1955, and the divorce, because then he got to know that woman now was working for the Ministry of Interior. You know, Ministry of Interior was like the police, like the FBI, you know, in Cuba.
Yeah.
You know, he got to know that then they divorced, and Rita Balat was a daughter of a very rich man. In fact, you know, they had their honeymoon in New York. And it was funded by the father. He had plenty of money. You know, very, very rich woman at that time. But then, after the divorce, Castro had, you know, quite some affairs, you know, with some other women who had children with him. And until 1980, when he married Dalia de Soto del Valle, married another woman in 1980. At that time, he must have been, you know, much have been advanced in age. But that woman has remained his wife until his death, you know, officially. But well, not much is often heard about, you know, about her. But officially, Dalia Soto del Valle is Fidel Castro's widow.
Okay, and is that it? That all the love that has ever been in the life and times of Fidel Castro?
No, in between, he is supposed to have had a number of affairs. And as I've already mentioned, you know, children with other women. Officially, he's known to have left behind six children.
That's six officially. Children.
But even when I was in Cuba, you know, it was rumored that he had other kids, you know, with some other woman, maybe some extra two.
Extra.
But that was his life, yes. You know, after his divorce, obviously, you know, he would have affairs. You know, because he was single until 1980.
All right. So you're saying, obviously, is this a matter of fact? Is this you? And doubling into a bit of conjecture there.
Yeah, I mean, looking at him from But he divorced his wife since 1955. I mean, the marriage has really collapsed. He couldn't get hands around.
Yeah.
But he had lovers. In fact, he had lovers, one of whom was said to have been recruited by, he had quite a number of lovers. He was recruited by the CIA to kill him. And that was in 1956. Her name was Marita Loren. He was giving he was to smuggle a jar of cold cream with poison pills to Fidel Castro.
Okay.
And then if he used those cold cream, he was going to give him skin cancer and, stuff like that and kill him. But Castro was alerted to this, So that's one of the lovers. And then when she got into the room, now Castro actually gave her a gun and, told her to shoot him. But her legs failed to love the man. And that failed, so she couldn't shoot him. So quite a number of lovers that he had, that was one of them who actually tried to do him in, under the auspices of the CIA.
You know, there's this, tell me what you know, because we have a very brief history of this woman, Marta Francisca de la Cardinada Diaz Balart. It seems as though she was very insignificant in his life, because we're talking about a life that was, or at least his spousal relations with Fidel, lasted for about how long did he last with Fidel? Because we're told that she didn't last much long with Fidel. Do you know much about her?
Well, I said that, they got married against the wishes of their families. And that Balart family were one of the oligarchs of Cuba, very well-to-do. And that was in 1948. At that time, 1948, how old was Fidel Castro? He was just 22 years old. And here was a guy who, at that age, was traveling around trying to foment revolution. At 21, he was in Dominican Republic, as I've already told you. At 22, he was traveling around Bogota and Colombia. He was not stable.
Yeah.
So, he was not stable. I mean, the guy was running around, fomenting trouble, getting arrested, and
yes,
around and being hunted by government, could not keep a family life. So that was the life of a revolutionary. So there wasn't much, settling down, of having a real family life. And then the woman went to work for the Ministry of Interior, and then subsequently officially they divorced in 1955. But they didn't, hang around together too long.
All right. We're going to leave our conversation right here, and then hopefully we'll make time to continue the exploits of Fidel Castro, because we have a great man who, even when meeting Nelson Mandela, there's very interesting anecdotes there, which at some point needs to connect, because at some point Cuba plays a very prominent role in South Africa. In fact, you mentioned Cuito Cuanaval, which is a point in our history that we need to chew on just a little bit before we say we are done talking about Fidel Castro. So we'll invite you once again and talk more about the life and times of Fidel Castro. Bush?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think we should, because Cuito Cuanaval was very significant and a turning point, as Mandela said, in the liberation of our continent and our people, and from the scale of apartheid.
Yeah.
So this story would not be complete without the narrative of Cuito Cuanaval.
Indeed.
Yes.
All right.
And if you want more, they should visit my Facebook page, Real African Writers.
Real African Writers.
I've posted a lot of history of Fidel Castro on that page.
Okay. All right.
And also finally to say that, there's great thanks to Fidel Castro. When I was in Cuba, apart from all the generosity of the Cubans, they also made available their beautiful Cuban woman.
Okay, Bush, okay. Now we know why you went to Cuba.
The beautiful Cubanitas. So they were advised by the Cuban ambassador that if you wanted to learn the Spanish properly, you have to kiss the lips of a Spanish of a Cuban woman.
Okay. All right.
And we came back very fluent.
Ah, I see. All right. Please do not forget that we have much to talk about the life and times of Fidel Castro. Perhaps we might even include there the bits about Raul, because Raul helped to take over from Fidel when Fidel could not continue his rule. And so when we continue our conversation, we'll touch a little bit. We just may not have time to talk about Raul in and by himself, but we will touch a bit about him because he helped with the rule of Cuba when Fidel couldn't continue with his role due to ill health. Push Kami, thank you very much, man, for coming through and talking to us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for the invite once again.
All right. It's 30 minutes after 1. This was The History Tunnel.